Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Jake Paul's going to join us in the second half. He's going to call out his next fight. So stay tuned for that. Andrew Klavan joins us as well. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. 60% of Americans believe it's likely that identity theft will cause them financial loss in this year. So it's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives every day. We put our info at risk on the internet. In an instant, cyber criminals could harm your finances and credit. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they'll send you an alert and you'll have access to a dedicated restoration specialist. It's LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours, yours, with LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year at LifeLock.com, promo code Adam. That's LifeLock.com, promo code Adam for 25% off.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
What's going on, Ace? I think if you buy Tiger Woods Genesis, you officially go into fuck me money. Happy Tuesday Day.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Jake Paul is joining us. Jake's got a fight coming up this Saturday. That's April 17th pay-per-view against Ben Askren. We talked about Ben quite a bit before the show started and got everyone caught up with him. And you can get it at Triller, T-R-I-L-L-E-R, fightclub.com. Is that correct?
Yep. TrillerFightClub.com. Thank you for having me, Adam.
My pleasure. So this thing that started off as a whim or a goof or a hobby is kind of turning into a job, fighting, right, Jake?
Yeah, it's this snowball effect. It started off small and now you can't stop it. So it's pretty crazy to see how far it's come.
I'm reading here that you said boxing has helped save you from self-destruction and going crazy. Can you give us some insight into that?
Yeah, you know, I just felt like I found my purpose, you know, and being in Los Angeles as a young, you know, star and coming off of a Disney Channel, you know, there's a lot of madness that you get thrown into, and you get thrown into this fake world where everyone's trying to, you know, get something out of you and use you to get to the next level, and people are backstabbing you and you don't know who your true friends are. And, you know, boxing sort of helped me find a purpose in a community where I fell in love with it, and it gave me something to focus on every single day. And I felt like I had so much to fight for because, you know, growing up, my whole life was a fight, just moving out to Los Angeles and trying to make it and become successful and overcoming all these different obstacles and things that have been in my way. So for me, I just love it. And like I said, it's saved me from, you know, a lot of, you know, bad places and going down the wrong path.
Yeah, they usually put those boxing gyms in the inner city to save not so many tall blonde guys in that gym being safe from a horrible future. But your last fight was Nate Robinson, and you dispatched him in a minute and 24 seconds of the second round. That you seemed clearly superior in fighting skills than Nate, but Nate was a basketball player. Now Ben Askren is a fighter with a kind of emphasis on wrestling in his background, but he's a fighter. So what do you expect on Saturday night?
Well, look, you know, I expect my toughest challenge yet, but yeah, I'm prepared. And I've been training nonstop for a while now. I can't even tell you how long, and we've had an amazing training camp and professionals and guys with really great records. And I'm prepared for anything that he brings into the ring. And no matter what he does, it won't be enough. And you know, I expect to knock him out just like I did with Nate Robinson. And look, I've been working for this. I've been trying to tell people, and I guess Saturday night is my time to showcase what I've been doing.
Well, it'll definitely make you legitimate fighting a guy with a serious UFC record, or at least mixed martial arts record. He's 19-2-1. You got the size and the age on him too. Ben's 36. I don't know. I know his background is in wrestling, but I know you cannot enter the UFC unless you have pretty good hands as well. How good do you think his hands are?
Look, I mean, there's a lot of talk around, like, is he a good striker? Is he not a good striker? I mean, this guy has been in there with, you know, Robbie Lawler, Damian Maya, you know, some of the best fighters and strongest strikers in the world, and he was able to, you know, sit there and exchange with them. So we'll see. You know, I guess Saturday night we'll see how hard he worked. And we'll see what his striking ability is. But like I said before, it's just we're prepared for anything that he has to offer. And I do plan on knocking him out.
What do you think about Dana White saying he'd bet $1 million on it? Is he going to? He's not going to do that, though, is he?
Well, he sort of went silent. You know, I came back and I was like, double your money up. Put your money where your mouth is. Me and Snoop Dogg, you know, teamed up, and Snoop was like, look, Dana, double your money up. I got my boy Jake. Let's make this a real bet. Let's ink it. And Dana sort of went silent. So I think he was running his mouth until it was time to pay up.
What do you think this is going to do for the UFC if you knock out Ben? And then what's it going to do for you? Are you then going to look for more so-called legitimate fighters to fight versus, you know, YouTubers or folks from different sports?
Yeah, look, I mean, last fight when I won, you know, 60 people called me out, like literally 60 people called me out. And so after this fight, I imagine the same thing is going to happen. And I imagine it being a bunch of MMA guys, a bunch of boxers. So I guess we'll just see what happens. But this is the start of a long journey for me. And like I said, I love doing this. So I'll keep on fighting and just figure out who the best opponent is and continuing to make amazing fights.
What's the financials of it? Do you get a taste of whatever the gate is, like whatever they do on the pay-per-view? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, each deal is sort of different. But yeah, the more successful the event performs, obviously the more everyone makes. So, you know, a lot of the reason I got into boxing as well is because of how exciting the business side of things are. And I'm an entrepreneur at the end of the day.
Do you also think about doing some promoting and like matchmaking, like putting people together? I mean, it's sort of like an Oscar De La Hoya thing, you know, eventually you become the promoter, you become the matchmaker.
Yeah, no, there's definitely talks of that. And it's something that's super interesting to me. And I guess we'll see where this goes. You know, my platform is getting bigger and bigger, and I would love to help young fighters become known and help promote their events. I just want to bring more eyeballs to the sport of boxing, and I love the sport, and I want it to grow because I think it deserves the most amount of attention out of any sport.
Well, it's kind of interesting that I've always followed boxing. I used to be a trainer back in the day, blah, blah, blah. So boxing was huge. MMA was considered a weird backyard fighting league. Now, MMA is probably eclipsed boxing to some degree. And the thing that might bring boxing back is these kind of what I would call novelty fights. I don't mean that as a put down, but I just mean, like, you know, Conor McGregor fighting Floyd Mayweather. Right. These are crazy kind of fights that might end up drawing more people back into the sport. And I would include Jake Paul in that. Do you agree with that statement, Jake?
No, for sure. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, boxing we have to look at it from an entertainment perspective. And that's really what I want to bring to the table and help innovate in the sport. Because you look at the NFL, right? There's halftime shows, there's mascots, there's, you know, fireworks, there's planes flying over the stadium. Like with boxing, you sort of show up, the bell rings, they fight for a couple rounds, and that's it. So how can we make this sport of boxing more entertaining? I think on Saturday night, you're going to see, you know, the first evolution of that with all these different actors, performances, undercards, you know, skits throughout the whole entire show. It's not just about the fight. It's about the whole entire broadcast.
Gina.
Just for lay people like myself, what does a day of training look like to you? I imagine every day is different, but I'd love to get an idea of what that looks like.
Yeah. So like on a super hard day, we'll be hitting it two times. We'll wake up in the morning, maybe hit a 5, 6, 7 mile jog with abs, neck workouts, push-ups, bear crawls, doing some strength and conditioning, pull-ups. That'll be the sort of the morning workout. And then usually go into like a recovery with like ice baths, saunas, stretching, all of that. And then usually in the middle of the day, you take a nap to sort of regain some energy. And then you go into your nighttime boxing workout, and that either consists of sparring, you know, hitting the heavy bags, working on the mitts, speed bags, jumping rope, and just punching things for an extended period of time.
Bear crawls is my gay porn name, by the way. Hey, Jake, who would you, let's just say you knock out Ben Askren. Give us three, or who would you be your fantasy fight for your next fight? Who would you like to call out?
You know, I think we'll see. It's hard to say. And, you know, I think a lot of the fighters who I want to fight, Dana White has to let them out of their UFC contract to be able to do it. But, you know, this all sort of started with the aspiration of fighting Conor McGregor one day, and I think that is becoming more and more realistic, and there's talks with his team about making it happen. So I think Jake Paul versus Conor happens in the next 36 months to 2 years for sure.
Wow. How does the you have Justin Bieber performing, you have the Black Keys, Snoop Dogg's going to be performing as well. How does that part come together?
As far as the creative? Or
well, like,
mean?
How do you go, I know Justin Bieber, or does, you know, what gets Justin Bieber on this ticket?
I think everyone saw how big the last event was with me and Mike Tyson. And that was the eighth biggest pay-per-view event in history. And so when you do numbers like that, everyone wants to be involved in the next one because they want the, you know, attention. They want to be able to perform. They want to be involved in the money side of things, the business side of things. So it's just exciting for everyone involved when you do big numbers like that.
Yeah, that was Tyson and Roy Jones Jr. And you were the undercard. Is that correct? Or the co-main event?
Yeah,
they say. Wow, yeah, that was the eighth biggest pay-per-view in history?
Yeah, from a financial standpoint, the amount of money that it grossed was the eighth biggest pay-per-view in history.
Where do you have Tyson and Holyfield getting back together? Who do you like in that fight?
I got to go with Uncle Mike. You know, I met up with both of them. I was training with Holyfield here, or I'm not in Florida anymore, but I was in Florida training with Holyfield a bit, trained a little bit with Tyson. And they're both great guys, both legends, and I respect them both. But I think Mike's just still got that raw power.
Here's a question that might not be answerable. How much natural ability do you think you have as a fighter? I know you train your ass off. and I know you didn't start off doing it traditionally, but do you feel like you have gifts as a fighter, like power? Power's a thing, like they go, that guy's heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. That just means he has power. Some guys have power. Some guys don't. It's not always what you look like, right, or your physique or your size. Some guys are heavy-handed. But you only find out through training and through sparring and through fighting. Do you feel like you have gifts as a fighter?
For sure. You know, I grew up my whole life being an athlete. And so I was able to translate that into the sport. And look, my coaches, since I first started boxing, were like, wow, you actually have talent. You can fight. And they're not just blowing smoke up my ass. And everyone says it, you know, and they're so surprised all the time when I tell them how long I've been fighting for.
How long have you been training and fighting?
It's been about 3.5 years now.
Yeah. So it takes a long time, because not so much with the right cross, but like the uppercuts and some of the combinations and some of the stuff that's like a little more nuanced, like body shots, mm-hmm, and putting, mm-hmm, combos together. It takes a while. So to be where you're at in 3.5 years is pretty good. What is your best punch? Your right overhand?
I would say my jab, probably. Oh, yeah, or my straight two.
What are you going to come in? I know you're 6'1", and Ben's 5'10". What's he coming in weight-wise? What are you coming in weight-wise? Or what's your goal weight-wise? Or did you guys sign off on a weight?
Yeah, we're coming in at 190.
That's just the catch weight, just what you guys agreed on.
Yep.
Did you negotiate that? Did you want to come in heavier? Did he want to come in lighter? Because he probably fights a little lighter than that in UFC, right?
Yeah, he wanted to come in a bit lighter, and obviously I wanted to come in a bit heavier. I'm naturally walking around at like 205, so having to cut down about 15 pounds.
What'd he want to come in at?
He didn't really propose like that. I think like 185 or 180 they were saying.
When do you this is like into the weeds thing, but there's certain, I don't know who sanctions this fight, but certain folks you have to weigh in day of fight. Mm-hmm. Other places you weigh in the day before. If you weigh in the day before, you can dry yourself up, right, make weight, and come into the ring with an extra 15, 20 pounds on you. When do you guys weigh in?
We're doing the weigh-ins the day before, which is pretty typical now. That's sort of what you see across the board. So yeah, I'll definitely be a little bit heavier in the ring.
Last
fight, I gained like 8 pounds in like an hour after the weigh-in.
Because you had to like dry yourself out. How'd you do that?
Yeah, you know, it just limiting your meals and water consumption in the days leading up. Sometimes you have to jump in the sauna and sweat off a couple of pounds.
So where are you at right now? And then how much do you have to get down? Well, we can figure it out by Saturday.
I'm probably at 198 right now. So okay, about 6 more pounds.
Well, this is a thing, and this is an interesting thing, and I think a lot of people kind of wrote it off as some sort of circus sideshow a few years ago, but it's turning into a thing. I mean, this thing is at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, and it's got a bunch of A-listers performing on it. Who's on the undercard? Is there anything we need to know about the undercard?
There's some good fights. Regis Progre, who's like one of the boxing's up and coming stars, and then Joe Fournier is fighting this guy Ray Khan, who's like a big Spanish or Colombian artist. There's some other interesting fights. Frank Mir, who's a UFC
it's a legend.
Legend is going up against Steve Cunningham. So I'm excited for that.
I know who Frank Mir is. Frank Mir has a, I don't know if he has a record, but he's had a lot of heavyweight title fights in the UFC, but I don't know who he's fighting.
Steve Cunningham, he's a former world champion in cruiserweight, so he's got a lot of boxing pedigree as well. So sort of a legend from boxing and a legend from the UFC.
Cruiserweight is the weight between light heavyweight and heavyweight. Mm-hmm. For Gina,
yeah.
Well, this is gonna be a fun night. What's the pay per view cost?
It's $49.99, and you can get it at trailerfightclub.com. But it's also a Justin Bieber concert, so you're really getting a bang for your buck.
Wow. This is, entertainment's entertainment, man. I'm going to get this thing and watch this thing. It's going to be a fun night. And again, in a way, I feel like these kinds of fight nights are sort of what the UFC was several years ago, where some people scoffed and went, this isn't boxing. And they're like, yeah, it's entertainment. It's a combat sport. It's something different. Jake, we wish you well on Saturday night, and we'll be watching.
Amazing, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Again, thanks for having me on. And I think it's sort of almost a tradition now for me to come on your show before I knock these guys out.
I'm your good luck charm. Thanks, Jake Paul. Appreciate it.
Awesome.
All right. Let me hit a quick spot, which is Air Medcare Network. Health insurance doesn't always cover the full cost of emergency medical flights. Even with comprehensive coverage, you could get hit with a substantial copay and deductibles as well. Plan ahead in an emergency. Air Med Care Network's highly trained crews provide air medical transport to the nearest, most appropriate trauma center. With Air Med Care Network membership, you pay no out-of-pocket expenses for the flight, and AMCN membership covers your entire household for as little as $85 a year. That is just $85 a year. Secure your financial peace of mind. As a listener, you'll get up to a $50 e-gift card with a membership. With a new membership, you get a $50 e-gift card. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Adam. Use the code Adam. All right. We'll bid adieu to Gina and Bald. We'll talk to Andrew Klavan right after this.
You will get Ace Man's favorites. You will get awesome booze for $25 shipped to you. You better believe. There's some real cool nuts. You know that you want that.
You heard Dick. A new month of Adam's Monthly Nut has arrived. April will feature Righteous Felon Beef Jerky with flavors like Chipotle Guevara and Habanero Escobar. Expand laces, because who doesn't want to turn every shoe into a slip-on? At least sometimes. You'll also get a copy of Daddy Stop Talking and a bottle of your choice. Prep your mails box, because Adam's Monthly Nut is on its way.
All right, Andrew Klavan is here. Andrew Klavan is the host of the Andrew Klavan Show, and it's every Friday evening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and, of course, the Daily Wire. And he's got a book out as well. He's got many books out, but The Emperor's Sword. And he's written over 30 suspense novels. I've hung out with Andrew a little bit socially as well when we went to Dave Rubin's house and had a steak and a scotch. Good to see you, Andrew.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So you got an interesting route to where you are today. You went to Berkeley. Your dad was a New York radio DJ when you were growing up. You've had a really interesting path to where you've ended up. How did you get from, you know, young Berkeley student and screenwriter and novelist to what I guess conservative talk show host?
Yeah, I was always a bit of a – I was a liberal. I grew up a liberal, and that was my family background, and that's, you know, kind of the air I breathed. But I was always a little bit disgruntled. I was disgruntled by – you know, I worked in the campus radio station for a while, and they had a Native American block and a black block and things like that, and I thought it was nuts. And when they started – basically when the Bakke decision came down, when they started with affirmative action, I thought liberals are out of ideas. You know, they just haven't figured out a way to make things right for them according to their vision. And ultimately, when Reagan was elected, I thought what all liberals thought, he was a warmonger, he was stupid, he was an actor, he was a fool. And one day I'm watching television and the Berlin Wall comes tumbling down. And I just remember thinking, you know, that old buzzard was right about everything. And shortly after that, I moved to England. So I went to England for 7 years. And what happened there was away from America and away from American politics. And with American politics totally out of my mind, I had a chance to just shape my own thoughts and shape my own ideas. And when I came back, I suddenly discovered that the guys who were saying what I was thinking were guys like Rush Limbaugh and the crew at National Review. And I realized right in the middle of a kind of a hot, you know, Hollywood career, I realized that I was on the other side of everybody I knew. It came as a shock to me because I'd been far away from America and far away from, you know, our politics and what we were talking about.
Yeah, I grew up in a very liberal environment as well. I never went to Berkeley or college at all, but my mom was very liberal, very kind of hippie, progressive. And my grandmother was that way. She was even like a communist for a while. And everyone was very sort of hippie, progressive, and very liberal. And there's a couple things I noticed. Like, I noticed two things. I noticed they were broke and they were miserable. Like, those were two things that I gleaned right off the top. And just in a constant state of, you know, what's going on with the indigenous people. It was one big extended episode of Billy Jack. And I was living in the middle of it. And I was like, God, you fucks are so miserable. And then as I hung out for a while, I noticed that my mom was wrong about everything. Every prediction she ever made, she was wrong about. She was worried about the microwave oven. She was worried about sitting too close to the TV set. She was, you know, constantly convinced that the man and white bread was going to take us all down. Ironically, the only thing my mom never worried about was the sun. We would be outdoors in cutoffs running through the sprinklers for 9 hours in a row, you know, in the middle of the summer in the San Fernando Valley. And I'm sure everyone has skin cancer now. But it's funny. She never railed against or worried about the sun because the sun was natural. You know, that wasn't created by the man. Union Carbide didn't make the sun. So it was this weird paranoia about corporations and this also bizarre relationship with the government, which is, I hate the government, but please give me another welfare check and some food stamps so I can eat, but I still will hate you.
And it was the constant fear of oppression and that their freedom was going to be taken away. The only people who ever told me not to say something or that saying something was wrong were all on the left. No right winger has ever told me to shut up. Only on the left. And I remember things like, I remember the reason I left the country. This is literally the reason I left the country for 7 years. I was sitting at a dinner party with my wife and we had just had a son and we had a daughter. And I said, gee, boys and girls are really different. And the entire dinner party went silent as if I had passed gas. You know, it was just like they were absolutely just embarrassed that those words had come out of my mouth. And I turned to my wife and I said, baby, we're living in the country. We're getting out of here. I'm not going to live in a place where I cannot say the most obvious things, where I can't say what's right in front of my eyes. And that has just metastasized to this point where people are just absolutely terrified. They're walking down the street terrified of saying something wrong in America. And it's all the left. It's all the left. We fascists, we oppressive, we racist, terrible people aren't telling anybody anything. We're not telling anybody to shut up. We're not telling anybody to lose their job. We're not doing any of that stuff. And yet the left is constantly worried about the rise of fascism while they tell corporations to shut everybody down. It is a bizarre lack of self-awareness.
Well, I can't figure out if it's just all projection. You know what I mean? Like, I live in California. We have Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom calls Trump a fascist dictator and then explains you have to shut your business down, otherwise you're going to get arrested. And you're going to, you can't play volleyball on the beaches. You can't paddleboard in the ocean, or we're going to send a PT boat after you. Is it all projection? Like, especially this discussion of freedom of speech. You know, like, we're all for it, but are you? Are you for it?
You know, when I complain about this on Twitter, a lot of times leftists will come on and say, oh, you're just unhappy that you can't say racist things behind closed doors. And the fact is, I never do that. Like, who are they talking about? And it feels like they're actually revealing their own conscience. I think it's a combination of projection and deflection. I think the powerful people, I mean, here's the equation. Powerful people love power. You don't get power unless you love power. And once you have power, you want more power. The basic conservative principle is that the power of powerful people should be limited. So I think that when powerful people start to call us racist and sexist and phobic and fascist, you'd think that even moderately intelligent leftists would start to say, huh, you know, am I being played? But I think at the same time, the powerful people are deflecting attention from themselves. The rank and file are projecting onto us. They're projecting onto us the things that they think are evil in them and have to be suppressed. And that is the idea of leftism, basically, that somehow there is some perfect person that you can force other people to be. You're already, I guess, there. I don't know. But like you are going to force people into being the perfect person. And from my point of view, human life is kind of hilarious. And if you're not like making fun of other people and making fun of yourself and kidding around about stuff and feeling free to do all that, you're just going to be building up steam and hostility that's going to have to come out somewhere. And I really do think that's what's happening on the left. A more humorless bunch of angry, blaming people I've never seen. And yeah, I guess, I think it's projection in the rank and file, but I think at the top, it's deflection. They know what they're doing. They own the media. They know they can call us names and have it stick and make it stick. I think it's a good technique. It works.
Well, the other technique is them painting everyone with such a crazy brush, such a wide brush, you know. Like, I think of myself as a liberal. I get called right wing all the time.
Yeah.
Now, when I grew up, in order to be right wing, you had to be against abortion, have a gun, you know, like John Wayne movies, be religious. I'm an atheist. I don't own a gun. I'm agnostic on abortion. I've said my entire career into a microphone, you want to grow a pot plant in your backyard? Grow a pot plant in your backyard. It's your backyard if you're paying taxes. If you start selling weed, you know, this is 25 years ago, if you're selling it to the neighbor kid, then okay, maybe the government gets involved with that. But I was sort of small government and staying out of other people's way and pure just libertarianism. Again, somehow, and this is the interesting brush, I'm pushing back against huge government overreach and closing down businesses, outdoor dining, when there's no science behind it. And then somehow I become some right wing QAnon guy, which is part of the plan. That's paint everyone with this brush who dares disagree with you. And it, you know, and I don't even know why half this shit's political. You know, hydrochloroquine, it shouldn't be political. If you want to take it, you should be able to take it. Consult with your doctor. Why is everything? So what they've done is this fantastic job of taking guys like you and me who are free thinkers, who you tell me the subject and I'll give you my answer. I don't have a set of answers to give you. And again, you pick what you were very typical right-wing things like religion and abortion and drugs and guns. You couldn't check any of those boxes with me. But somehow, because I'm not down with crazy Gavin Newsom or Joe Biden or whatever the next piece of legislation is, it's going to shut down our freedoms even more. Because I'm not down with that, then I've become a, you know, right wing. And by the way, you're not just right wing, you're ultra right wing or super right wing. It's insane. Right. And people should push back against it.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, they're making it as hard as they possibly can to push back at all. And for me, this is the dividing line, because I have to admit I've become more of a conservative caricature over time. I'm working on becoming Alex Jones. You know, I'm trying my best. But, I just don't have the appetite, I think. But to me, the dividing line is, can we talk about it? Can we discuss it? Can we argue about it? Can I be wrong and not lose my job? Can I say something that's a little untoward and not be hanged in the public square? Why not? I mean, why can't we do that? Why isn't it possible to have two people sit down and say, you know what? Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe I am a racist. Maybe this is a terrible thing I want to put forward, and just argue about it. I mean, I've argued with racists. I've argued with all kinds of people, and I didn't turn to smoke. I didn't disappear. It's as if we're so fragile that if we hear an idea that may be untoward or maybe even ugly, that we're somehow going to become that thing. We're going to be transformed in the moment. I could care less what people think for the most part. And I want there to be argument. I want there to be discussion. As I've always said in the movie business, I mean, I kind of was thrown out of Hollywood for being who I am. And as I always said, I don't want them to stop making movies. I just want right-wingers to be able to make movies too. I want people of all kinds of everywhere on the spectrum to be able to present their vision, not just at the movies, but on TV. I mean, how boring is it? How boring is it that you turn on late night comedy and every single comedian has the same set of opinions? How can that be? I mean, how can it be that like only one set of people get to make jokes at the other set of people? And how is that supposed to be good for the country? To me, the dividing line is speech.
Go ahead. Oh, speech. Sorry.
No, that's it. It's the openness to.
Yeah. There's something I've been yelling about for a long time. And I have a way of predicting things. 15 years ago, I was saying, if you let every jackass bring their dog on a plane because they got a note from their doctor, everyone's going to be traveling with their dogs. And then there became a problem with people traveling with their dogs. And now we've instated a bunch of rules to correct it. I see things coming down the road. I wrote a book 11 years ago called In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks. And most of the stuff I predicted happened much faster than 50 years. So that's what I do. I figure out which way the wind is blowing. And this whole thing, this whole race issue where Obama's out there doing it. I mean, you have the traditional race hustlers, your Al Sharptons and your Jesse Jacksons. But now you have a kind of quiet version and a more dignified version that the Obamas do and Oprah does. And everyone's been doing it now. It's going to destroy this country. How could it? How could this work in any country? There is no country where you could pit the Sneetches against the Snoofles or whatever. You know, and Dr. Seuss is banned now, so we can't use that example. But I was listening to the radio today, and this is something Tucker Carlson has kind of been saying as well, and guys like Dennis Prager. They had a White Lives Matter rally in like Huntington Beach last weekend, or 500 people. Right. How long can you have a Black Lives Matter before you have a White Lives Matter? How long can you talk about systemic this and cops that and teach critical race here? How long can you do that before you create, essentially, forget about Jim Crow 2.0, Klan 2.0? And well, the Klan exists. Yeah, it exists, but not really, not barely, not in any meaningful numbers. How long before the other side goes, well, all right, we're going to start our own league. We're going to start. It started with White Lives Matter rally. I was in Huntington Beach. There's going to be a lot more. And then what?
And what's your argument against it? If your argument is, you know, whiteness is bad, what's your argument when somebody says, well, whiteness is good? I like whiteness. I'm all down. I'm all in with my whiteness. What's your argument going to be? Don't be racist. You've already thrown that argument away because you've been as racist as it's possible to be. It's oppressive. You know, it is funny in America. Every race has come under, attack. Every race has been made fun of. Every race has been excluded. You know, and I do understand that Black people have the extra step that they have to take because the oppression happened here. I mean, most of our families came here to get away from oppression. Blacks were dragged here in chains. And I understand that that's another step you have to take, another imaginative step. But if you don't take it, Nobody can fix the past. Nobody can go back and change those things. Those things are done. They're finished. And they didn't happen to you. They happened to somebody else. This kind of relentless insistence that you're a victim, a relentless insistence that you alone, of all the people in the country, have to be treated in a special way, has got to backfire eventually, because either the argument is, look, racism is not a good thing. It is a good thing to treat all people like children of God. We're all here together. The planet is the size of a marble. We're sitting here in the middle of vast, endless space. The idea that we're going to hate each other over this stuff is ridiculous. Either that's your argument, or your argument is one race is better than another, and then it just becomes a battle who wins out. I mean, that's what you're seeing now, is eventually white people are going to say, hey, you know, there's an awful lot of us, you know, and we're going to fight back on this. And I don't want to see that happen. I think that this is a country that can easily digest people of all races and make them Americans and let them be Americans. But that's not going to happen when, A, you keep harping on the race issue, and B, you keep telling people that America is inherently racist.
And the goddamn politicians, with the constant beating of the drum of scared of people who look different than you. That is such horseshit. It's so insulting. First off, I mean, I live in Los Angeles. It would be impossible to exist if, in fact, you were scared of people right. who look different than you. Imagine living in Los Angeles. Like, oh, what's that guy? He's Armenian. Well, get him away from me. I mean, it would be the most tortured existence imaginable would be living in Los Angeles and scared of people who look different than them. First off, I would like to have sex with most people who look different than me. There's just
they look sufficiently different.
I'm looking for the most different from me so I can have sex with them. I do not want to have sex with my own doppelganger. This notion, it's so insulting. Now, so here's the question. What percentage of people believe it versus what percentage of people are just goddamn cowards and just kowtow and just go along? Because I think there's so many people that just go along.
I think so, too. And I think what you have, what becomes confusing is there are a group of loudmouth activists in every single one of these identity situations who put themselves forward as representing the group that they are acting on behalf of. So, you know, I'm an artist. I've worked with gay people all my life. Most of them are kind of conservative people. They're talented people. The guys I've worked with have all been good guys. But then you get a guy go in and tell some baker in the middle of Colorado that he's got to celebrate their life with a cake. And he says, I can't do that because of my religion. And so they try and shut him down. That guy comes to represent gay people in people's minds. People think, well, the gays are those guys who go in and they shut down your cake shop. So you don't want to mess with them. You don't want to say anything about it. But I don't like them very much. You know, it just goes underground. The hatred just goes underground. Most gay people, I think, are looking at that and thinking, leave the guy alone. Let him bake his stupid cake, you know. And I think the same thing is true. I don't know. It seems to me that whenever anybody actually leaves his newsroom, which almost never happens, and goes out in the street and actually talks to black people in the streets, they're going like, yeah, don't defund the police because I'm going to get myself killed. They're saying, you know, I'm not a victim. I just want to build my business. I want to do the thing that I'm – whatever it is I'm doing. But they have managed to make it. I mean, think about this.
Well, by the way, they go, don't defund the police. And I have an ID. Of course, I have an ID. Just go down to the DMV and get an ID. Right. Yes.
I mean, think about this. You know, whether or not Derek Chauvin was a bad cop and whether or not that was a bad arrest, put that aside for just a minute. George Floyd was a messed up guy. This is a guy who held a gun on a pregnant woman while his friends home invaded her house. That's what he did. And now there are pictures of him all over the country with little angel wings floating up to heaven. So you're saying to people, you know, your hero is not Clarence Thomas. It's not, you know, the greatest jurist of our age. It's not Thomas Sowell, one of the greatest philosophers of our age. Your hero is this thug, this clown, you know, who's been in trouble all his life and died stuffed full of fentanyl. He's the guy who's rising up into heaven. Who believes that? Who believes that? I do not believe that the rank and file of people sit around and look at that and say, yeah, that's my hero. That's who I want my son to grow up to be. You know, and I just think that this is a theory, you know, a theory created to conserve political power, put forward by politicians and then professors and then maintained by a homogenous press. And I don't think it does represent what people think. This is the thing. I actually think that 70% of Americans agree on 70% of the issues. And I think that there is a wall built by the media to keep us apart, to keep us hating each other and suspecting each other so that we don't sit down and talk and find the places where we can compromise. This has always been a very live and let live country.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, this notion of, like, we always have to sit down, have an honest dialogue, or not. We could all just get about our lives.
Or not talk to each other.
I don't mean not talk to each other. I just means, like, I have guys I work with. I have people in my life. I have friends. I have neighbors. We don't have to sit down and have a dialogue. We just go to work. You know what I mean?
Right.
And we could have that. This country is great at doing that. And I agree. The press is going insane with this stuff. They are stoking it. They're getting to the point where they're going full Jussie Smollett. Like, they are just lying about stuff. There used to be an omission. Maybe it's a commission now thing. I mean, it used to be that they would kind of, well, if a white cop shoots a black motorist, we'll hit that a little harder. And if a white cop shoots a white guy, we won't give that as much ink. Now they're just flat out spinning. They're going so goddamn hard in every direction. I mean, look no further than COVID. They're all just dove in on the panic porn and they all went in. And this isn't a conspiracy theory. I knew it. I knew it early. The first thing out of my mouth is, where are the ages? How come they're not telling us how old these people are? How come no ages? Because they wanted this to think this was a universal offender, that this disease could cut down your 13-year-old son as well as it could cut down your 91-year-old Nana. They've been going hard at COVID. They were going hard at race. They've been like almost weaponized now, and I don't think people really fully understand it. I feel like people think, well, there's CNN on the left and there's Fox on the right, and that's kind of it. No, it goes a lot deeper than that. There's Los Angeles Times, New York Times, even, I mean, I turned on CBS 60 Minutes the other day. I saw the Ron DeSantis like hit hatchet job they did on. It's like, that's CBS. That's 60 Minutes. I mean, you don't have to like Ron DeSantis, but that was not a piece of journalism that they did. And that's CBS mainstream.
Look at the Georgia voting thing. I mean, the networks are reporting this as an attempt to restrict voting rights. That's the assumption built into their headlines. The Georgia's attempt to restrict voting rights as opposed to cleaning up a messy voting system so there'll be less fraud. It's to restrict voting rights. They lie in the headlines almost, and all their assumptions are left wing. And part of this is a panic that's set in with the onset of the internet, with the onset of the democratizing of information. That is when this kind of panic reached the panic point, reached this kind of wildfire of lies that we have now, is when suddenly, you know, I could say to you, hey, I collected this information and I think that there was more fraud in this election than people say. And I put that out and people can see it on Twitter. Now Twitter has to shut you down. Now Facebook has to shut you down. Now social media has to collude together to make sure that the wrong think doesn't seep out into the public eye. What is going on, really? I mean, this is the thing. So much of this is about failure. The failure of the Soviet Union was a huge turning point when all these socialists whose ideas had been incarnate in that country suddenly found themselves with millions of dead bodies on their hands and a financial and economic system that didn't work. They had to explain that away. I mean, I think a normal person would have said, well, you know, it sounded like a good idea, but I guess not. I guess after 100 million people dead, maybe I'm going to change my mind. But no, instead, they went into places where those ideas couldn't be tested. The academy, the news media, and Hollywood are places where you can put forward ideas without testing them against reality. And that's where the left went, because there they can say what they have to say without it's ever coming a cropper. And as things fail, as ideas fail, instead of just saying, oh, this idea failed, I'll throw it away, what they do is they keep trying to get a hold of more of the information landscape so they can control the flow of information instead of just, you know, throwing your hands up and saying, you know, this communism thing, that doesn't really do anything for anybody.
I don't know that the average American knows that as much of this is going on. They hear little bits and pieces. You know, you had 50 former FBI and CIA officials all sign a document saying that the Hunter Biden laptop was a Russian hoax, except for it's not. These are officials that all signed this, everybody. Former directors of the FBI all signed a document saying this thing was a hoax. It wasn't. It exists. I don't know to what level it exists. It's certainly not a Russian hoax. And then the news reports that there was a YouTube roundtable where epidemiologists were basically arguing whether or debating whether kids even need to wear masks at all. And YouTube took it down. I'm sure you're aware of that story. They're taking down information from epidemiologists and doctors who disagree with them. I don't think people really know what's going on out there. I don't want to sound like, you know, QAnon alarmist guy over there, but there's a lot of editing going on out there, and people should be aware of it.
No, and the thing is, you know, you remember that movie Men in Black where the alien comes down and eats a guy and then goes up and uses him as a kind of set of clothing to pretend to be a human being? That's basically what the left does. What the left does is it takes over the New York Times, which back in the 80s was an absolute great paper. It was always liberal. It was always to the left, but it was a great paper. You go back and read that. It's a totally different newspaper. So they take it over. They empty it out. It is now not a newspaper at all. It's just a leftist talking sheet. But it's still dressed up like the New York Times, like in Men in Black. You know, Yale is still dressed up as Yale University, but Yale University isn't a great university, certainly not for the liberal arts anymore. It's just leftism walking in a Yale costume.
Well,
they're very good at this.
I want to talk about why this is good for you, though, and the Daily Wire. First, I'll tell you about Geico. Do you own, do you rent your home? Well, you do one or the other. How about you save some time, save some money, and bundle with Geico? Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners and renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around the house. So you go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save when you go to geico.com. Do it today at geico.com. Now, the Daily Wire and many other voices and your name, people like you and Ben Shapiro. And now I just saw this article about, you know, Greg Gutfeld wins a demo and Time and Late Night and all this kind of stuff. Of course, it's just going to create opportunities with people who don't echo the thoughts of the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, CNN, MSNBC, and the list goes on. So in a way, the biggest benefactor is Ben Shapiro, right?
Well, one hopes. I mean, they're doing everything they can to demonize and shut us down and make sure that it's just amazing that Fox News, which has, you know, it's a big cable station, but it has a tenth of the viewership of the networks, has just obsessed the left. They just obsessed that there should be even one cable station, one tiny cable station that's fighting back against them. The Daily Wire is the same thing. They have guys at Media Matters, the George Soros company. They have guys listening to us every day. What a sad life that is. They listen to us every day trying to find things that they can, that we say that they can take out of context. So on paper, yeah, it is great for us. They're serious. The left is serious about shutting down opposition. They are serious about shutting down free speech. The New York Times is running major articles saying, shouldn't we reconsider this free speech business? They mean it. They're not kidding around. When Twitter, look, when every social media outlet can take the president, the former president of the United States, who got 75 million votes, and silence him, something has gone terribly wrong. And I have friends on the right who are sitting around going, well, you know, it's free enterprise. They're not a government entity. They can do whatever they want. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is 90% of the information landscape out there, and they can silence Donald Trump? I don't think so. I don't think that is going to be the way we preserve our rights. So, yeah, right now, the Daily Wire is thriving. It's doing great. We are developing a voice that we wouldn't have if they weren't trying so hard to shut us up. If they would just ignore us or stop, you know, we would just be another voice in the wilderness. But because they oppose us so deeply, we rise on that jet fuel. But still, ultimately, it's dangerous to have these people rampantly shutting down speech and to have their toadies and their followers going, yeah, that's that. They're hate speech. Hate speech is bad. And hate speech is anything that disagrees with my speech. It's a dangerous moment because they are losing control. You know, it's kind of a lot of people I know compare it to the invention of the printing press. which follows this attempt to shut down all printing, you know, by the Catholic Church. And I think that this is kind of what's happening. The internet is a threat to entrenched power. Our elites, as we've learned during COVID, our elites and our experts are idiots. They don't know what they're doing. And so they have to silence, as you say, they silence a doctor who comes out and says, you know, you guys are wrong. They have to silence that. And that's what worries me. Yes, right now we're thriving. We're doing great. But I'm worried that ultimately that makes us a target of very powerful people who are not hiding their motives or their methods anymore.
All right. Let me take a quick moment and tell you about our friends over at Apartments.com. Apartments.com, with the most rental listings anywhere, there is no wrong way to find your right place on Apartments.com. You could smear your phone screen with peanut butter and let your furry roommate lick their way to a new pet-friendly place. That's how easy Apartments.com is. Or use a tablet like a Ouija board and call up your late nana. Apartments.com even offers virtual tours so you can explore your potential place from anywhere with an internet connection. Bar on a bad first date, tandem bike on the beach, wherever. From tried and true methods to virtually enhanced techniques, you'll discover that special somewhere on Apartments.com. The most popular place to find a place. Well, Andrew, this has been an interesting conversation, and we're going to continue this conversation on your podcast. So when we clock out here, I'll arrive on your podcast, Andrew Klavan Show, and you guys continue to listen to our conversation. I want to thank Jake Paul for phoning in and talking about his fight. I want to thank Andrew Klavan for coming in with his unique perspective. And until next time, this is Adam for Jake and Andrew and Gina and Bald saying mahalo.
Follow The Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can catch Gina Grad and Teresa Strasser on their podcast, Easy Listening, and Bald Brian on his podcast, The Film Vault. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744, and be sure and pick up one of Adam's books, movies, and more. They're all there at adamcarolla.com.
Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.
The 2020 presidential campaign in the United States was a pretty wild spectacle to watch, no matter what your political perspective may be. But there was one particular bit of rhetoric that jumped out at me. It was a criticism of Donald Trump leveled by Bernie Sanders that made use of a well-known historical tidbit. Here's what Sanders had to say.
Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Trump golfs.
Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Trump golfs. The senator was riffing on one of the best-known stories from the history of ancient Rome. That is, that during a great fire that consumed the Roman capital in the year 64 AD, the self-absorbed Emperor Nero not only did nothing to help, but laughed and played the fiddle while his city burned. It's the kind of story that many people know, even if they know absolutely nothing else about Roman history. For a whole lot of people, the history of Rome is basically just Julius Caesar, Beware the Ides of March, and Nero Fiddled as Rome Burned. So, in a way, it's not surprising that this story has proved so enduring. It's just too perfectly symbolic. If you need a historical example of the ruling elite being hopelessly and heartlessly out of touch, I mean, this is it. Nothing quite says, I could care less, like playing a jaunty little tune on the fiddle. But we really should ask, is any of this true? Did the Emperor of Rome really sit back and put on an impromptu hoedown as his city crumbled beneath his feet? Well, here's the thing. If he did, there was no way he played the fiddle. In 64 AD, the violin hadn't even been invented yet. The instrument as we know it today wouldn't come into being for another 1,400 years at least. To give you some historical context, Nero playing the fiddle is basically the same as Charlemagne shredding the electric guitar. In 64 AD, the violin was an impossibly futuristic instrument. But we do know that Nero was an amateur musician and was particularly fond of an instrument known as the lyre, which was a small Greek harp. He was known to put on long recitals for his advisors where attendance was mandatory. So the original story was that Nero actually played the lyre and sang as the great fire ravaged Rome. But there's good reason to doubt that story too. The most trustworthy Roman sources inform us that the Emperor Nero wasn't even in Rome when the Great Fire broke out. In fact, we're told that the Emperor rushed back to the city as soon as he was informed so he could personally oversee the relief effort. So, Nero didn't fiddle as Rome burned, and he didn't play the lyre. He didn't sing. He didn't sit back all smug and laugh as his people suffered. He learned about the fire through messengers and did his best to respond. Now, that doesn't mean that Nero was somehow a good emperor or even a good guy. In fact, he was probably one of the worst. But the fiddle, well, that just wasn't a thing. Nero fiddling as Rome burned is a perfect example of what I call a historical myth. A little legend that got wrapped up in the transmission of our history and often gets repeated as a historical fact. My name's Sebastian Major, and on the podcast Our Fake History, we explore these historical myths and try to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. The podcast is one part storytelling and one part historical detective work. I do my best to bring these weird stories from our past to life, while also asking probing questions about whether or not we should believe them, and how these misunderstandings took root in the first place. On Our Fake History, the goal is to celebrate everything that's weird and wonderful about the past, while also thinking critically and trying to grab on to the slippery concept known as the truth. If Our Fake History sounds like it's for you, then subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.